8, 6, 1, 0.
Welcome to the Radio Art Hour, a show where art is not just on the radio, but is the radio.
Oh, radio, radio. Uh-huh. Radio.
The Radio Art Hour draws from the Wavefarm Broadcast Radio Art Archive, an online resource that aims to identify, coalesce, and celebrate historical and contemporary international radio artworks made by artists around the world. Created specifically for terrestrial AM/FM broadcast. Whether it be by commercial, public, community, or independent transmission. Come on a journey with us as radio artists explore broadcast radio space through poetic resuscitations and playful celebrations, subversions of the complex relationship between senders and receivers in this hour of radio about radio. Go to wavefarm.org for more information about the Radio Art Hour and Wavefarm's Radio Art Archives.
I'm Tom Rowe at the Wave Farm in New York, and today we're going to hear a radio tale from Esther Beauty and Gabi, narrated by Jeff Strauss, and we're going to hear two classic radio artworks from the 1985 cassette tape from Telus called The Sound of Radio, one from Rick Harris and another from Edward Haber. But we start things off today with Crisis Baby Crisis, a radio tale by Esther Sabuti and Gabi, narrated by Jeff Strauss, about a young, wealthy couple moving from one metropole to the other in an attempt to escape the political and ecological crisis that each new place confronts them with. They observe the world around them without ever feeling rooted and move whenever things get difficult. Esther Sabuti provided the text and the sound design was by Gabi. Here is Crisis Baby Crisis on the Radio Art Hour.
Max was born in Brooklyn in 1988. He was an only child. His parents were both professors at NYU. They lived in a brownstone in Carroll Gardens. At the age of 5, he looked and acted like an adult. He wore little round glasses and leather boots. His hair was smartened up, and he had an opinion about everything. His routine was strict and his life was calm. This monotony was broken on his 13th birthday, when the Twin Towers exploded and collapsed. Shortly after, his parents decided to leave New York and to start fresh in a rural town in New Jersey. "We've just had enough," was his mother's only explanation. Eloise was French. She went to art school in Marseille, where she studied video art. She had just finished her thesis, an installation of different clips of film she had recorded during her trip through China. These clips were projected onto cardboard boxes she had found in the trash. She was attempting to demystify the supply chain, or so she claimed in her artist statement. Eloise and Max met during the recession of 2008 at a party on the roof of the terrace of La Cité Reduce, the Radiant City. The flat roof of Le Corbusier's famous building was designed as a communal terrace with sculptural ventilation stacks, a running track, an exhibition space, and a shallow paddling pool for children. They stood near the pool and gazed at the unobstructed views of the Mediterranean and Marseille. They enjoyed not understanding each other and talked with their eyes, smiles, and awkward gestures. Max's French didn't exist, and Eloise's English sounded like French with an encrypted vocabulary. She wanted to say something smart about the European debt crisis, but her level of English wouldn't allow it. She stared at the bubbles of her Aperol spritz, wondering who would break the silence next, but nobody did. They remained silent for the whole night. Thank you. They dated long distance until Eloise decided to move to Brooklyn to live with Max. The last time she tried to visit him, there was an ash cloud over the European sky. The volcanic events in Iceland paused air traffic for 6 days of her vacation. Meanwhile, Max found a one-bedroom apartment for them on Richard Street in Red Hook. The apartment was on the west side of the street, where 19th-century fishermen's houses were renovated into artist lofts and formed the edge of what looked like a movie set, implanted onto the old industrial port. White people wore cowboy hats and sat with their backs against the tree trunks in the park. Others walked their pit bulls, and they drove Land Rovers. On the east side of the street, the projects began. The square brick buildings were replicated over the next 10 blocks east and north until they abutted the highway overpass. All buildings had varying heights, widths, and depths, but the repetition of the red brick and the square windows made them look identical. Separated by little alleys without trees, the raw labyrinth reminded Eloise of the game Tetris. Inhabitants of the east side of Richard Street worked twice as many hours as the inhabitants from the west side, but earned considerably less money. The police surveilled them and often arrested or harassed them for fun. Officers would hand out tickets for concocted transgressions so they could fine people. These fines turned into records. The records sat and inflated until the next arbitrary arrest sent people to jail. Some people from the east side of Richard Street even disappeared and were never found again. On liquor store's door, the signs for missing teenagers accumulated. When Eloise moved to Red Hook, she routinely jogged through the rectangular red buildings until the day Max told her that it was embarrassing and painful for others to watch how easy her life was. One day while she jogged, she saw hordes of rats run up the sides of the red brick buildings. The sky grew dark, and the wind blew wildly. That night, Hurricane Sandy hit and swept away their one bedroom. Shaken, Eloise urged Max to move back home to France with her. Max didn't mind moving to Paris. He loved French movies. His projector at home was like a prehistoric fire, always flickering foreign movies, music videos, or domestic and foreign newscasts. Once in Paris, he bought the same projector and the same set of IKEA furniture they had had in Red Hook. After the sun went down, the usual TV channels lit up their living room walls. Netflix, Hulu, Al Jazeera, Democracy Now!, CNN, MSNBC, Disney. It didn't matter where they were. The world was a big movie theater in which reality disappeared, behind an abyss of images within images. Thank you. Eloise's first concern in her life was beauty, her own beauty, as well as the beauty of the arts. She was an image that produced other images. One morning, while she wrote a check at the bank, she stumbled upon a perfect pen. She took extraordinary pleasure in writing the numbers, the date, and signing with this ballpoint. The pen was light and sturdy, as if welded inside her hand. It felt like an additional finger from which ink leaked at the same pace of her own bloodstream, drawing the curves of her soul and measuring the moods around her. She went to CVS next door to buy a pack of 15 black ink Pilot 92s. There exist only a small number of encounters with perfect products in one's lifetime. This was one of them. Back in her studio, she doodled all day long. The lines poured out of her pen and overflew the present without privileging it in any way. She thought about how the transient was rendered eternal and immovable on paper, like a piece of music on a 12-inch LP. Beauty was constantly on the move and hard to catch. It was a fast traveler with light luggage. As she walked home pensive, people ran in all directions and shouted for her to get out of the streets. A man grabbed her and dragged her inside a random building to protect her. A dozen or so terrorists drove around the neighborhood in jeeps, shooting at people cruising in the cafe's terraces. The song of sirens increased and decreased gradually, in a crescendo and decrescendo. Her phone beeped and vibrated hysterically. Twitter, Instagram, SMS, Telegram, Skype, Signal, a city alert, and 24 missed calls from Max. A week later, they moved to Israel. Max was shocked by the terrorist actions and didn't feel safe in Paris. He feared for anti-Semitism. After having received the keys to their new flat, they stood on the balcony overlooking all of Tel Aviv. They heard a far-off syncopated shouting, becoming more and more distinct. Eventually, the protesters marched underneath their window. They called the names of Palestinian teenagers, doctors, journalists, resistance, that had been incarcerated for an indefinite period of time, with no trial awaiting them. The list of names was long, and so was the procession. Eloise posted a picture of the dramatic sunset that shone on the protesters' signs on her Instagram. Max added a short video clip of the crowd on his Twitter feed. They felt a taste of real-time responsibility and empowerment. The internet is like the Athenian public sphere, thought Max. Cyberspace is the home of the mind. It's a free marketplace for ideas and can generate revolutions. Suddenly, everyone could be Martin Luther's or town crier speaking truth to power and proclaiming that they didn't want to be governed while sitting in their living rooms. Max believed religiously that the internet was linked to freedom. But not much later, his tweet received angry reactions from strangers, along with worried messages from family members, begging them to come back to the U.S. Max was confused. The information highway was also a nationalist machine that spread rumors and lies. The clock of feeds rendered the new, old, and the old, new. His phone made the crisis into something personal. On top of that, it normalized it. Cyberspace was actually home of confused minds and sentiments that traveled at different speeds, bumping into each other, and forgetting that they just did, Max ruminated. Was thinking now reduced to hardware, he asked himself. For Eloise, there was no doubt. To be meant to be seen. Her phone offered her presence with an absence. More importantly, to be was also to be updated. She changed her profile picture every morning, as well as her avatar name. She worked on it before going to bed at 8 p.m. right before the curfew started. She went to sleep early and woke up at 5 a.m. to FaceTime with her friend who lived in Sydney. They often gossiped about high school friends they hadn't seen or heard for many years, but knew of their awkward destinies through social media. Many, many years later, after Eloise and Max had lived in St. Petersburg, Brussels, Tokyo, Rome, Berlin, Montreal, Rio, Mexico City, and Vienna, the state of emergency was still the system under which most sovereign nations governed. People of color were harassed on the daily. The police was militarized and the military was policized. Soldiers loitered in public spaces with machine guns. The state of exception was not a special kind of law. Rather, it was the end of law. The exception that proved the norm. Since the provisional had become the rule, the granting of full powers to the executive from the executive remained. People believed they needed to be saved via corporate, governmental, or technological intermediaries. The police froze the country with so-called safety, and new crises or attacks were always welcome to justify the state of exception. Thank you. The airplane in which Max and Eloise sat flew through the perfect obscurity of the night sky. It had departed Barcelona, where they had lived a couple happy months in a beautiful apartment on the Passeig de Gràcia. Eloise, who had done her Erasmus in the Catalan capital, knew the city well and loved it for the agreeable weather, the beaches, and the Roman arts. Max fell in love with the architecture and started to learn Spanish. This jovial and friendly atmosphere shifted with the Catalan people's uprising against Madrid's government in the attempt to become an independent state. The divisions were omnipresent. Every dinner party turned into a political debate or a fight. Tourists like them were pointed at. Max started to learn Catalan instead of Spanish, and then there was a van attack in Las Ramblas. They decided that they were tired of Europe and the general anti-EU sentiment of their Catalan peers. They wanted to start fresh, somewhere unknown. Thank you. Max and Eloise held hands and slept in their seats next to each other quietly. Their flight was half empty because a pandemic was beginning to spread around the planet. They looked identical with their matching face masks and transparent plastic shields that covered their facial orifices. They both dreamt the same dream under their shells. Things seemed to stand still. The airplane flew fast and far over the ground through the night. For the first time, they rested while moving.
That was Crisis Baby Crisis, a radio tale from Esther Sabuti and Gabi, narrated by Jeff Strauss on the Radio Art Hour. Next, we're going to hear two works from the 1985 cassette tape from TELUS called The Sound of Radio. We start off with this excerpt of Rick Harris's Is This Real?
My body isn't listening to me. I can't remember the word for what I need. I need someone to explain everything. Bring all the specialists in the world together and explain.
When someone has a stroke in the left side of the brain, and brain cells die in any of the language areas, the frontal, the parietal, or the temporal lobes, aphasia can occur. Aphasia is a Greek word meaning no language. Every aphasic person is different. Some aphasics can write words and not understand their meaning when they read them back. Some can do complex mathematical problems but be unable to form a sentence. Some can read aloud without understanding what they read. Some can read music but not words. Often, an aphasic person will be thinking about something, will try to express it, and completely unrelated words will come out. As the aphasic person relearns language, the struggle is to say a sentence, not just a string of words.
Once to be, once to be, we to be, once to be, once to be. We to be, we to be, once to be, we to be, once.
He said that every word would bring up so many images, thoughts, memories, other words. They would push each other away. They would tumble over each other. Chaos.
If my hands could move now, if my fingers could move, I would go to the piano. Touching music with my fingers, touching sound with my living fingers. Music, touching music, touching music, touching music. Be thou exalted above the heavens. Let thy glory be above all the earth. Let mine enemies wander up and down for meat and grudge if they be not satisfied. I will sing of thy power. Yea, I will sing in the morning. From the ends of the earth will I cry unto thee. Now, my heart is overwhelmed. Give me my music back without words of God, without that throne, that kingdom, that office. I hate. Yes, I wish everyone were blind.
That was Rick Harris with Is This Real from the 1985 cassette The Sound of Radio from TELUS. We finished the Radio Art Hour today with another track from that release. This one from Edward Haber, also known as Citizen Kafka, and it's called Abbott and Costello Meet the Antichrist.
This Sunday, stay tuned right after Tapeworm Baseball for Abbott and Costello Meet the Antichrist.
Bud Abbott is the Animus.
Lou Costello is the Anima.
Spring Byington is the Magna Mater.
And John Ireland is the Beast.
In Abbott and Costello Meet the Antichrist.
Check.
What is it now, Costello?
Look at that throne.
Which throne?
That throne, the Holy of Holies.
You mean the seat of the throne of Jerusalem?
I mean the throne of Jehovah. I saw him sitting there.
What's the big deal? There's nobody there. Oh. Will you stop fooling around and shut up and pass me the Kabbalah?
Chick, I saw him there.
Who?
David Rockefeller.
Look, if I see you hitting the Holy Sacrament one more time.
See our two GI jerks say nuts to the Nazis like this.
Now, Homer, listen to me. It's simple. The forces of dark and the forces of light will fight for the last time.
You mean like Joe Louis?
No, Homer, the apocalypse.
Oh, yeah, apocalypse, so I like that Jamaican music.
No. Don't you understand? It's Armageddon.
Armageddon what?
No, not Armageddon. Armageddon.
I don't understand. You tell me there's a final fight between dark and light, but it's not a title bout.
That's right.
You tell me it's Apocalypso, but it's not Jamaican ganja music.
That's right.
You tell me it's Armageddon, but the only thing I know is I'm getting tired of trying to figure out this book of revelations!
See Lou go gaga over curvaceous Hillary Brooke, but bite off more hosts than he can chew when he winds up to his stripes in hot holy water.
Homer, it's kind of hot in here. How about if we step outside to the veranda?
That's okay by me, lady.
Why, you adorable little thing. You're shy, aren't you?
Shucks, yes, ma'am.
Oh, call me Hillary.
Okay, Hillary.
Well, if you're ever lonely, Homer, you can give me a call. You won't regret it.
You're a nice lady. What's your number?
Here, it's 666-666-666-666-666-666-666-666-666-666-666-666-666-666-666-666-666-666-666-666-666-666-666-666-666-666-666-666-666-666-666-666-666-666-666-666-666-666-666-666-666-666-666-666-666-666-666-666-666-666-666-666-666-666-666-666-666-666-666-666-666-666-666-666-666-666-666-666-666-666-666-666-666-666-666-666-666-666-666-666-666-666-666-666-666-666-666-666-666-666-666-666-666-666-666-666-666-666-666-666-666-666-666-666-666-666-666-666-666-666-666-666-666-666-666-666-666-666-666-666-666-666-666-666-666-666-666-666-666-666-666-666-666-666-666-666-666-666-666-666-666-666-666-666-666-666-666-666-666-666-666-666-666-666-666-666-666-666-666-666-666-666-666-666-666-666-666-666-666-666-666-666-666-666-666-666-666-666-666-666-666-666-666-666-666-666-666-666-666-666-666-666-
right after Tapeworm Baseball.
That was the Radio Art Hour, mostly put together from the work of Wave Farm Radio Art Fellows. Go to wavefarm.org for more information about the radio art you heard featured on the Radio Art Hour.
The preceding show was recorded at Wave Farm's WGXC in the Hudson Valley in New York State.